very exciting for me. People talk about rocket scientists in the world, and they typically mean people who actually have nothing to do with business schools. Well, Elias is one of those people that actually is a rocket scientist in the business world. He and I went to the same undergraduate institution in Germany. We played in the same orchestra. He made the terrible mistake of getting a PhD in Stanford. For a number of years a professor in computer science at NYU, and got then recruited out of there to become the chief scientist at Amazon, where he was responsible for implementing a lot of the systems that they have. And since 2004, he's been roaming the world and enlightening people on how to do data mining and how to basically work in very data-rich environments. And it's an absolute pleasure to have you here. Thanks.
Florian, thank you very much for inviting me. So Florian told me yesterday that you might hear something about recommend assistance. And so here's what I want to do with you in the next hour and 50 minutes. I will talk about recommenders, and I want to get some points across. I want to get the point across that marketing, in my perspective, really has become feedback. What do you mean by that? Then I'll talk about Web 1.0 versus Web 2.0. Many of you probably have heard the term Web 2.0. Just ran 2 weeks ago the Web 2.0 conference in Germany, so I think maybe I know a little bit about it, which I would like to share with you. Then I'm going back to recommend assistance and talk to you about the shift which we have seen from focusing on the individual customer, not the customer, what you did in this course, to modeling the situation the customer is in. And then if there's time at the end, if you have some questions about how these things actually work in organizations, I would be happy to try to answer any questions you have which are outside the topic of this lecture. But I invite you to interrupt me anytime as we go along here if you have any questions concerning to what I'm talking right now. Good. So, and as Florian mentioned, I was the chief scientist at Amazon.com. And so I would like to start with an example from Amazon. And just in case you're wondering, the reason that you'll find Chinese slides is that I think, we need to be forward compatible. Because, I'm actually teaching executives at Tinkerton. So just ignore it if you don't know it, and enjoy it if you do know it. So you're a customer at Amazon.com, and you go to the website, and you click that button here, adding something to your shopping cart. So we are building up this thing here. And now, what we want to do is we want to figure out how can we make recommendations. Recommendations come in two flavors. One flavor of recommendations are compliments, stuff which you want to buy in addition to something else. My joke with Jeff Bezos always was, I got that in the golden card, in the gold box, so I thought I'd buy the laptop, which goes with the battery. So compliments are stuff in addition to it. And the other kinds of recommendations are substitutes, things you buy instead of something. Now, Amazon is a totally data-driven organization. So none of these things have people who just figure out, if you like this, you might like that. But it's all based on the behavior of people in the past. The recommendations at Amazon.com are purely sticker recommendations. So if you click on this item, and within 24 hours buy that item, you click on this one, buy that item, then you increment that cell in a matrix about 15 million times 50 million entries. You increment that cell one, and then when your neighbor clicks on that item you clicked on as well, the fact that you bought some other item means that he will be shown the fact that, hey, people click on this, eventually end up buying that. So basically, you contribute to Amazon's database simply by doing what you're doing there anyways, namely looking at stuff and buying stuff. Similar to Google, where the relevance algorithms get constantly tuned by people being basically guinea pigs in, which of the 10 things do you find interesting, clicking in those, and the background of those algorithms constantly getting better, based on the back which you give by using the system. In any case, so these are the two kinds of recommendations, and I want to start with a very simple thing right now. So we came up with the recommendations, and we have the stuff which is a shopping cart. Question for you. Do you think that blue thing should be on the right-hand side or on the left-hand side? Who thinks it should be on the right-hand side? Okay, that's about half of the class. Who thinks it should be on the left-hand side? Okay, fewer people. So we could be thinking about what does it say about you, but we don't want to do that here. What I want to know is how would you make that if you were in charge of the website at Amazon? Arm wrestling, it's one possibility. By salary, by status, how would you make that decision? Should it be, again, on the left-hand side, or should it be on the right-hand side? Yep.
Some experimentals may be out of control.
Exactly. So we run so-called A-B tests. So let's say half of the those whose customer ID is an even one, you show it on the right-hand side, and those whose customer ID is an odd one, you show it on the left-hand side. And yeah, how long does it take you to know the answer? What do you think? As a physicist, you know, you're used to sort of order calculations, and roughly a million people coming a day. Square root of a million is 1,000. 1/1,000 is 0.1%. So after a day, you can measure effects of the order of 0.1%. Not bad. Huh? So maybe you wait for the week to sort of average out day of the week effects, because people on Saturday actually behave differently from people on other days of the week. What is missing in our conversation right now? Any idea? So the term control, treatment and control, from pharma in the olden days, I say A-B test, because we said half of the people we allocate to left, half of the people we allocate to right, so we actually hear those two groups already in here. Which is, no. What's missing is,
I was just thinking, is it something to do with left-handed, right-handed people, so in the control groups you have to make sure that you have the random sample which takes from...
Okay, so it's hard to do better than chance, easy to do worse than chance. So in my experience, the best is just to really pick some random hash onto your customer ID, for instance, and based on that, associate with people. Because when you start arguing that maybe right-handed people, or how about people write Arabic language, but I think the other way around from the Western people, and they think the Western people write the other way around from them. So it is not easy, actually, to start with these arguments. So what you do is try to come up with some deep explanation, but you just simply measure it. What is it? That is the question. So what is first thing you do to figure out is what are the metrics which you really want to have for evaluation. So that is, work with companies, for instance, always the first thing we have a conversation on. Why? It's much easier to agree on the metrics you want to measure than on the outcome, whether it should be the left and the right. Yeah, people think, what are good metrics? Give me some examples of good metrics for, let's say, Amazon.com. What would be good metrics? Yeah.
Clicks.
Are more clicks better or less clicks better?
More clicks.
Are you sure? But we can agree at least clicks is a metric. Because some people would say, if Amazon presents you with what you want to have right on the second click, maybe that's more likely that you go back there, and then if it takes you 50,000 clicks to get the product you want to see. We have your marketing opportunities, that we control your ads, that there are foreman grills on sale, etc. So let's come up with some better than clicks.
Some type of revenue conversion.
Okay, revenues are always good. Profits even better. Stock price even better. What other things do we have?
Shopping cart attrition rates.
Shopping cart attrition, that's a very specific one. Let's sort of lift it up one level. We could say, for instance, of people coming to the website, and we could say the so-called conversion rate. Of those who you attract, how many actually do buy something? And then you see that often these metrics have trails between each other. That, you know, we all know how to increase the number of hits on AdWords. But if we now have like free sex as a keyword at Amazon and people come to the site and they don't find what they're looking for, maybe the conversion rate is going down. So you see, having that conversation about the 20 to 50 metrics your organization should have is actually a very important element. Okay, so once we agree on those, in this case we had two, we had the conversion rate plus size, then it indeed turns out that half of you who thought on the right hand side is better was right, and it's roughly 1% effect, so after a couple of hours you are really sure that that effect actually is there and makes it worth it. By the way, all my slides are, if you go to vigen.com, /teaching/Tsinghua right now, because Stanford, I do everything in a wiki, so the Tsinghua slides, whatever you want to see, you know, you can find there. Or Google Index, so probably if you enter your shopping cart and second thing will pop up right away. Good. So that was the first lesson, that before we think about anything like recommendations, we worry about what metrics do we have. That is good for short-term effects. One problem is that long-term effects have very different elements in the modeling. Long-term effects are hard to model. Short-term with these experiments, no problem. Long-term effects are much harder. Because, for instance, at Amazon, at some stage we had this brilliant idea that if Google AdWords at Amazon, Google AdSense, those little ads, boy, every day a check of about $500,000 arrived. But you have to show people that what they looked for at Amazon, they could get somewhere else, maybe cheaper, until they slowly don't come to Amazon anymore. So 0.3% of the customers which we tracked based on a number of things, and based on that we decided, maybe we should not get cash of $500,000 a day and lose customers in the long term. So feedback is the key thing, and you as an example here is that implicit feedback, which you get based on what people respond to in condition A, in condition B. Now, after the metrics, as a second level, we have architectures where we have, after data collection, that's what I talked about right now. After that comes architectures of experiment. This is pretty much what we call Web 1.0. Web 1.0 is about business. Feedback is much richer than that. The next three levels are architectures of participation, architecture of interaction, and architectures of collaboration. With interaction, I mean people interacting, like, you know, two people hooking up on a dating site. With collaboration, what I mean here is coming up with community, sort of not just us hooking up, but really creating something together, like, you know, the wiki, for instance, I use in my course at Stanford. So let me talk about those. For the data collection, if any of you is interested, actually, I would be happy to entertain you. My last homework was having people develop an online consumer confidence index. Who of you has heard of the consumer confidence index, the conference, you know, since that 23 years?
This is what, the Michigan, right? It's Klaus Cornell?
Yeah, it's a sort of standard CCI. Yeah. People have heard about it. Talked to somebody at the World Bank last weekend and says about half of the decisions, policy decisions, are driven by that funny index. Funny? About 1,000 cards to people. 5,000 cards, and see what's coming back. And they ask them, so how do you feel about the economy? How about now? How about in 6 months? It's what drives half of the policy making in the United States of America. So we thought with a company called Hits, which has probably for most of you, your click data, because they work with most of the ISPs here and more than 10 million people in the United States alone, traffic being observed by HitWise. So we thought, if you want to know consumer confidence, maybe we should actually come up with something which is direct than asking 5,000 people how do you feel about it by seeing what search terms do they enter. Do they enter unemployment or do they actually recover? Maybe that gives some idea. Do they want to rent houses? Do they want to buy houses? Or we could look at eBay, for instance. It's sort of the minimum reserve price people have. Because if that goes down, then people are willing to, you know, just get some cash and don't worry about, you know, making the maximum profit they could in an item they're selling anymore, etc. So in my class with Hitwise, I set that as a problem, coming up with a much richer, much more predictive, the question again is predictive for what? What are the metrics here? Index, and we're working on that right now, and by the end of December we will actually publish that and probably have a Harvard Business Review article based on that. So that was a small remark here on data collection, what you can do when you collect rich data from 10 million people as opposed to sending surveys to people every month. Experimentation there, sort of my background has been shining through. I'm an experimental physicist by training. It used to be that we shoot partings onto each other at Slack, for instance, and then we observe what's happening, what races do they leave, and then we come back and say, well, if that's what's happening, we believe that the party has that mass, etc. And the same is for the LED business, the same is happening on the web, that we show people different things, we see how their trajectories are, and then based on that, we come to conclusions what we should do with them. One big difference between this attitude, experimentation, and most of what you've learned is that in order to do these experiments, think the A-B test I showed you, in order to do those, you already have actions in mind, left side versus right side. And one of the things which is very problematic, if you just do your logistic regression and networks or whatever you're doing, then it is not really clear what actions should be taken after that. So you don't know whether you should, for instance, more people search than you would like to have search because the search is basically broken on the website. It's unclear whether you should make the search smaller or bigger or what you should do in terms of actions. So this approach, the experimental approach, which is based on getting feedback in real time, deeply relies or deeply fosters the primacy of the action because you have different actions in mind and then how does the system respond? That's much, much more close to the, you know, what business should do. There's analysis, paralysis, and not know what were the findings they get at the end of the day. Yes?
So feel free to not answer now if you're going to get to this. But one thing that Professor Wolfe brought up was customer attributes. So in the data collection, when you're talking about metrics, you just show these two different groups, left versus right, and which one gets the better response rate, basically. But then you have, as we've learned in this class, specific to customers, so things like left versus right, or culture, or whatever it may be. How does that filter into this process?
Good. So really think this through deeply. If you know what metrics you want to drive, then you don't have to worry about whether somebody is left or right. Historically, here's how that has been arising. Indirect mail, you know, sending out stuff, I think you did the Capital One case, right? Indirect mail, all you know about people is their zip code, 94114, okay. So you draw conclusions about people living in 94114, and then on average, that seems to be a good thing to send them certain offers. But your past behavior is much more predictive of your future behavior than just where you happen to be living. It's the problem simply that you didn't know what to these offers, short of these, you know, fraction of percent to actually send them back. I was in Finland last week and gave sort of lock to the new strategy. The Finnish Post, of all places, is launching with Nokia. By the way, in the world, Nokia is better known as a brand than Finland. That's already interesting. And the idea is that the Finnish Post is delivering at any post tons of junk mail to people's households. So if we can create a value proposition for the customer by pulling out his Nokia phone camera and just taking a picture, snapping a picture off that label, and then giving a number between 1 and 9, how he loves getting that junk mail, suddenly you get much richer feedback data from people based on their behavior and not only their level. So that's an example here.
And there's actually, I think I don't know whether you do, so whatever, I think with the point
yep.
you still want to, it's still slightly different, which is, and I think it's one that you would truly agree to, which is that if you do your experimental design, sort of one of the factors that you ought to consider is that there may be an interaction effect of the stimulus that you're giving with some character of the customer that receives the stimulus, right? So in other words, and that can be based on, for example, behavioral segmentation early on. And it's really that the left thing works, if you can identify that the left checkout box works better for certain people that you have information on in your, in the right one, then that may be a degree of customization that you may want to engage.
Yeah, but I think in most cases, you really don't need that. You know what people are interested in based on their past behavior. And actually, I want to give you some example here. So let me actually just talk this for the moment, where we go through the different, to the four levels of data which we have. Pages become a visit. Okay, a visit or a sequence of visits becomes a customer. And a sequence or sort of a relation between customers becomes a network of customers. So let me jump to your question here and tell you a little bit about what the marketing concepts are on those four very levels of the, if you will, data pyramid. On the bottom, you have that you can mod the content of the page, and you can show ads. As you know, ads drive the internet economy, and Google's market capitalization of $100 or something like that is basically based on people showing their intention economy, and by expressing, we show you an ad which fits your intention. That's why the click rate is about 30% on AdWords. On AdSense, which this thing is, where based on the content of the page you show some ads, the click rates are less than 1%, but still better than nothing. Second is here this visit. So here you model the page. Here you don't just look at the page, but you look at the sequence of pages within a session, and the session is typically defined by being terminated by 30 to 90 minutes of inactivity. Session-based marketing. And there is one company which actually does that really well, called Cleverset. And both Peter Norvig, who is the other advisor now at Google, and Bruce D'Ambrosio actually got PhDs at Berkeley. Cleverset models the situation you're in. So there's a process of creating and maintaining product space awareness. For instance, if you go to Amazon.com and you enter digital camera, you have, you know, probably not the depth of understanding of the details between cameras as if you enter Canon 5D. Because then you pretty much know what you're interested in and you want to see what's cost here, what are the lenses, maybe something else came out here, stuff like that. So that's just a trivial example. What they do build is relationalistic models which take the structure of the product into account, have hidden variables like a hidden Markov model. I don't know how many of you are engineers. This stuff, if you want to model where a visit is, and then you want to do session-based marketing, do you want to show somebody a coupon? Because, you know, if they only get the 3% off, they're ready to buy, or do you just want to focus on education, what kinds of cameras they are. Examples of modalities of a visit are planned versus impulse, etc. Very different from the data which you have in mind. And I will judge in a moment. Here's the example I gave from the dating sites. Rather than trying, I worked at Match.com, I worked at Gay.com, I worked at Parship, a German company, which is doing dating sites, trying to really hard based on the clicks. Yes, you might as well ask people, what do you want to do today? Want to chat? Want to date? Want to hook up now? Want to travel? So, you know, just ask people. That often beats by far doing the modeling. Third level is the level of the customer. That's where you came from. Demographics, behavior. Extremely hard. First of all, you don't know the customer in most cases, but you just know the box. Maybe you've heard about that finding of ComScore. The average age of people on Facebook is 30-something. Yeah, we all know about predators and prey and all of that, but how is that possible? And the answer is the computers. Under the parents, because many of the students still live at home. So you have this bimodal distribution. Some have their own computer, other ones have the computer which ComScore believes belongs to whatever 40-year-old person. And that's why you just pick up facts if you try to figure out demographics. And that's just one triviality here when different people use the same computer. And so far, this one is pretty much taken care of by companies like Google, or Turn, T-U-R-N, which just tries to copy the context of the page and then show ads related to the context of the page. This is relatively easy. It takes like 24 hours of integration with the site because you learn the model along. This one is very hard. So lots of these CRM problems, why did Siebel basically, in Oracle, bought it and stuff like that, because it's just a very hard problem. At Amazon, typically a customer comes only 4 times a year. So how little do I know about you if you just swing by 4 times a year? Maybe once you buy something with your auntie, the next time you buy something with your girlfriend, and you'd quickly need a textbook for Florian's course. I mean, you know, that is not really just the holistic personality which you would like to see on having demographics data about people. So, done by others, easy to do, very hard and very expensive. There's one level left, namely the network level. The network level is a level which I did actually significant thinking about. So let me give you a feature for an example here, what we had at Amazon.com, that was a share the love feature. The belief is, and you've probably all read Malcolm Gladwell's book, the belief is that some people influence other people. Like Florian, when he sort of signs a textbook, he sells 50 copies of that, and that's probably more than he buys himself in a year. So if we could only identify those people who are influencers, then we would know that if we treat them really well, we have more ROI, if you will, or treating them well, whatever that means, sending them massage vouchers or so on, than if we just give it to some random dudes at the bottom of the food chain. So how do we find that? So you see the idea again, that how do we set up an experiment? So we elicit from people whether the powerful people influence others or whether they are, you know, just buying some stuff. And here's what we did. The lifetime value, which you had a couple of classes about, actually has two components. One component is the one you learned about, namely how many dollars in this country end up from Amazon.com from your pocket. The other one is the network value, and that is from the people VJ influences. How much of them is he going to get them to buy? So you took a problem. If you want to ask people questions like this, they will not tell you. So how do you actually get to that? That's really fun in systems, which gets you to that. And here's what we designed. We said, okay, so let's say VJ buys a book. No roadblocks in the checkout. So let's make sure he really gets to buy that book and pushes the button. Okay, but as soon as that, we say, hey, Vijay, do you have any friends who maybe might be interested in the same book? And we elicit some email addresses from him. Why would he do this? Because you get 10% off, 10% credit of what you just paid, if at least one of them buys the same book within a week. And to be fair, so if, let's say, Ray is one of your friends, and Ray buys the same book, then Ray gets also 10% discount within a week. So time consists, you know, interest, need to track. So now suddenly we know who the people are who forgot to turn their mobile phones off, also know who the people are who are able to influence other people. So then data analysis starts. So with this, I looked at it and I found there are some people who have 5,000 friends. How is that? What do you think? Who are these people?
Just copied their whole address book, right?
But who are these people? The authors, of course. The author of the book. Because he sent it. And everybody who knows wants to buy the book, 10% off. So you actually see what people, who are the people who actually have influence over others. And would you stop that, or would you say that's a good thing if they send it to their 5,000 friends? What do you think? I think it's a good thing because Amazon sells more books, maybe even acquires some customers, and that's about it. Understanding how you set up an experiment where people participate, so we're slowly moving from experimentation to participation, is an important thing which doesn't happen in the offline world, not in the offline world, but only in the online world where you do communicate. Okay, so that was my long-winded answer to your short question about what about right-handed people versus left-handed people. It doesn't really matter as long as you understand that this person or people who are in a situation like him tend to behave that way. It's easier to do because you have a million people coming to Amazon every day, so you have a million situations you can model versus you have only 4 situations a year if you focus on the customer. So to summarize, we had 4 levels here. We had the pages, the way to make money off pages, show ads. We had the situation or the session. The way to make money off sessions is to understand what mindset he's in, whether he's ready to buy or not. We had customer. There we have the demographics, very limited predictive behavior. And then on top, we have the network, and that is actually network marketing, which is an important component of people's customer lifetime value, which only very few companies right now are exploring. Okay, all of this has at its heart feedback. Now I promise you some examples of what has happened here in marketing and how this, which is called Web 2.0, is actually changing, I think, the way marketing is done.
In a business read article in November on Amazon, Rob Hoff, who's the local correspondent here, sort of came as quote for me saying that we're moving from e-business to me business. It's no longer the e-business. You know, why would I write something at Amazon as a review? You know, people used to do this in the 90s. They wrote some reviews at Amazon. If you can do it in your own blog, because if you do it in your own it, if you want to change it, you change it. If you do it at Amazon, who knows who owns it? Who knows whether Amazon will take it off because maybe it doesn't actually really foster the book. So we've moved from e-business to me business. And then in December, when Time Magazine decides on who is the person of the year, last year it was you. Yes, you. You control the information age. Welcome to your world. So this slide contrasts a little bit. Web 1.0, say 10 years ago, with Web 2.0, say now. Web 1.0 was a read-only web. So you talked about consumers. You talked about users. The term users only used in two contexts, web user and user. So there's no other context. We talk about users. Web 2.0, in contrast, is a read-write web where people can participate. Users is spelled a little bit differently here, or producers, or some people also call prosumers, alternating those two ways. Web 1.0 had its key business model to a teacher like 10 years ago, that you have to increase barrier of exit. You have to make it really hard for people to leave. I remember when my dad tried to unsubscribe from AOL.com, that was a week-long exercise of being on phone loops forever. No more. Now, it is to come up with as low barrier of entry as possible. So just get people, show them what you have to offer, as opposed to trick them into coming and then don't let them go. Pre-test and validate is what I'm sure Florian has taught you to do. Hey, no time for that. Launch and learn, because we have that feedback loop. We can just play. And that means that the cycles, I've moved from months to days, sometimes to hours of trying out new things. Do you know which version of Amazon you're using? Which version you're using? No, I don't know either, because you know things are changing all the time. Did you ever read the manual actually for Amazon.com? So you see that it's very different in terms of discoverability from what we have for trying to understand how to use Vista. Discovery is something which is very, very close to my heart. So how did discovery work here? In the old world, Web 1.0, discovery was based on hyperlinks. Yes, those in power, those are the ones who set those links. And all you was click on those links or not click on those links. Like, when I came back on Sunday from Europe, it was late evening. This is a true story now, I'm not making this up. And I was in first on United, but unfortunately I had the last seat in first, so they were out of food. So, you know, this well, would you like to eat with us? I said, yeah, well, what are the choices? She said, well, you can have steak or you cannot have the cheese steak. This is your choice. So that is sort of the discovery based on hyperlinks. That your opinion doesn't matter. There's no upward flow of those bits. In contrast to this, now we have different kinds of discovery. And I invite you, the problem set I gave to my class at Stanford last week actually was a really cool problem set where delicious. Who of you knows what delicious is? Okay, so maybe I actually should spend a couple of minutes explaining it. Let's take time out here for a moment and I will show you what tagging is about. So we talked about clicks. That's, you know, what you can do, but you can only click on stuff which is on the page. Then you can search. Search means that you can show your intention. Not as powerful as if you show something your attention. What do you attend to? What are attention gestures? An attention gesture is that you, for instance, forward link to your friend, or that you copy something from a web page into your class notes, or what would be other attention gestures online? What do you think? Pushing somebody to voicemail,
as opposed to answering them. It's, for instance, an example where you might not want to pay attention to a person. Right? What other things? What are attention gestures? You're nodding right now, or you are looking with an asking face. These are all examples of attention gestures. And attention gestures also to tag something. So if I go, for instance, what's your webpage, Brian?
Faculty.house.
Okay. So here's, for instance, your course webpage. And I can say, let me just tag this. I quickly hit tag, which means a bookmark that is running. And then I can say here, has, and as a tag I could say marketing. Okay, and save, done, all gone. Now the tags here are the collection of stuff which I have tagged. Here, for instance, a great page called The Digital Movement, one of the greatest blogs I know in Singapore. So apparently I do this stuff in order to remember it. For myself, I'm not doing it for others, I'm doing it for myself. I want to remember Florian's page. So, right. Second thing is, I'm willing to share that with the world. So I worked with Raptor before Delicious was acquired by Yahoo. And we talked very hard back and forth whether we want to allow people to have private blogs and lose that sort of default sharing, but gain some people who might sort of not want to have everything they look at now for the public, or whether we should just have everything public. And we decided to have everything public, and that's probably the right thing in order to get to the third. First was share. The first was do it for yourself to remember. Second was share, and the third was discover. So I want to talk about discover. How can this be used to discover other stuff? And if I go, for instance, to those people who at some stage in their life tagged Weigand.com. So these are people to Weigand.com and decided as they went through there, well, it's worth leaving a little note for myself. So here we have 150 people, and they make all kinds of comments. And now I have these trends of people who at some stage went to this page and left the breadcrumb there. They want to remember it. Now we don't have the statistical method, which I talked about with Amazon.com, where you have clicked on something and 24 hours bought something else, and we forget about your identity. But now we can follow all these people and see what else they tag afterwards.
When does the trail of breadcrumbs just become like old bread on the floor, though? You know what I mean? Like, when's when is it just like indistinguishable from a messy house?
By people more power to express how important something is for them. So what I ignored right now, I ignored the tags themselves. I only looked at the fact that someone tags a page. So there are maybe a couple of dimensions to my page. So I could look at how do people actually tag my page by as, you know, consult or big or whatever. So I can now, and this is the point I want to make, follow individuals and see where they're going afterwards. So I don't know, when I click here on Don Ralfredo, whatever that is, I have no idea who he is or she is, but I can follow them and see what else they find interesting. And this seems to be a German guy, but people talk in Germany. So this is different. Discovery now is no longer the statistical stuff I showed you at the very end, Amazon.com. But we now move from e-business to me business. It is following individuals. I was actually amazed. I went to just a party yesterday evening, and there was a person who I had never met before, who, you understand, Kurt, was there in the 90s when I was at NYU. And he even knew where I lived, because he found it interesting. I have my address on my webpage, I have a picture of Black.com, and that is really interesting that you meet people we have never met and they know so much about us. And how does it work? How does it work? By discovering it in business. Cool guy.
Isn't the knock on Web 2.0 that there
It depends on what it is.
You're in a minority. You're in a huge minority. One out of us actually did, but
let me give you some examples. MySpace. I did some consulting for MySpace earlier this year. It has certainly more than 100 million users. And it really is about user-generated content. It's about people discovering stuff. I have told, I'm not sure whether it's true, that more than half of the $30 billion music industry's discovery happening in MySpace now. So it's not one in, 100 people, less than that. For a certain age group of people who are comfortable, showing stuff about themselves, it is actually, I think, maybe if you think Facebook, MySpace, stuff like this, how many of you have actually a Facebook account? That's very different. Stanford would collapse if Facebook was shutting down. I mean, all social interactions happen through Facebook. That's very interesting. Who of you is... Same ones, okay. Who of you use computers, actually? So, I believe that it depends on what you're talking about. Companies work very hard trying to come up with their Web 2.0 strategies. Let me give you a couple of examples. And this is a very non-judging example here. I really learned something last week at the conference I ran, which made me think. General Motors, it's a company which market cap, I think, is half of what Amazon is, and whatever, 10% of Google. But they make physical objects, cars. And they thought, well, if we can get people, and now that's very direction, if we can get people to sort of share their wonderful experiences with their SUVs, then that would be great. So they opened up and said, hey guys, we want to hear your stories. And they heard the stories. Gas, environment disturbing, blah, 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 blah. So they got a huge amount of negative press. What could they suppress it? That would have been even worse. So what they did is they lived with it. Tahoe was the name of that SUV they tried to push. So until last week, the story was, see, that serves them right. They open it up and see they're in trouble. And then I learned that 30% of the SUVs sold, whatever the time scale was like last month, were actually GM SUVs. So it might have been negative press, but it certainly was press big time. So I don't know where the truth lies here. I just want to make sure that you understand it is, of course, a Pareto law, it's a power law, where you have few people contributing most of the content. Absolutely, that's what Wikipedia is, that's what Flickr is, that's what everything is, that's what the economy is. Bill Gates, if you aggregate income, I learned has the same whatever income or wealth as 40% out of all Americans. That's just the way the world is, power law, scale for distributions. But sometimes getting, it was in the tens of thousands of options for that, actually really has an effect. A better example is from China. Who of you know the Back Dorm Boys?
No.
Okay. The Back Dorm Boys, those two guys on the door in their red jackets who lip-sync the Backstreet Boys. Yeah. So I almost got them to class at last quarter, but they were too busy to talk to executive MBAs because they have just so much stuff they have. Exclusive with Nokia and blah, 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 blah. That's an example of, I think, having 18 million downloads of their first video. So, yes, people contribute, but we're still in the millions of views.
One thought I also had is I wonder also, partially, the statement that not that many people contribute, whether it also has a little bit to do with what we define as Web 2.0, right? Because, the seeds, what is now sort of classified as Web 2.0, are very, very old seeds. And in fact, you could actually argue that the internet started with Web 2.0 and then became it, because the internet used to be basically all about Usenet. And Usenet is a lot closer to Web 2.0 than what then happened once the web started up. And as a result of that, I think the basic idea that people do curate content, although only in perhaps very specific domains, I think is quite widespread.
Yes and no. You have Marxian Umschlag, whatever that is in English, the transition from quantitative to qualitative, if you give people technology. I agree with you. I started a company in 99 called Mood Logic, where the purpose was to create a data collection engine about music. And after 2.5 years, we had 1 billion explicit ratings, and we sold the company to all media data. So that very much is in the spirit of architects of participation here. But it was just not the typical thing. And if you look at this here, that is one way of contrasting, say, Web 1.0 was about commerce. It was about data gathering by clicks. It was about experimentation, no question about it. It was about impressions. That's very interesting that the metrics actually dramatically shifting. Web 1.0 was about impressions, about reaching people. You know, that's a funny, this is a funny metric that you count somebody who hits, you know, MySpace 1,000 times a day is just as much count as somebody who comes once a month by mistake by clicking on an ad. Web 2.0, on the other hand, really is about people. It's about individuals. I think that's a big contrast. As you said, from e-business to me-business, it's about interaction. And, you know, we can really think about what is the future of dating and mating. And it's about community and collaboration. Crowdsourcing, if you haven't read it, you should read this book, Wisdom of the Crowds. Crowdsourcing is more than just a social network. What I just did in class on Monday was 3 hours on prediction markets. Suddenly those things, which yes, would have been possible before and existed, did exist actually, our electronic markets, now those are used actually by people. So we are building a prediction market for startups where people can buy a contract, let's say, with a startup. Anybody has a startup? Favorite startup? One has heard about startups?
T-Mobile.
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 What's that?
It's a web video analytics company.
Okay, what's it called?
Tube Mogul.
Easy to remember, Tube Mogul. So the contract could be...
It's their own company.
Okay, okay.
They just won the business cycle.
All right. No. So
can't short sell, he doesn't have any money.
So we could have as a contract, for instance, Tube Mogul will be funded in a Series A by at least $1 million by the end of 2007. That's the contract. And if that's the case, then, you know, I give you $100. So now, how much would you pay for that contract to buy it from me?
Definitely less than $100.
Okay, that's a good starting point. Did you take, does anybody know Terry O'Dean here?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So Terry is just super great. One of the greatest people I know in these things. So that's sort of a Terry statement. But how much would you pay? Say you would say $5. That means you associate the probability of 5% with his company getting at least $1 million Series A funding by the end of this year. So those are all examples of what is very, very to do on the web right now. These interactions, which, you know, it takes an hour to set up such a market. Many collaborations, many companies, the government, I was just in Singapore a couple of weeks ago, the Singapore government uses prediction markets to get a feeling about long-term trends. So it was possible, like tomorrow, to prime example I used 10 years ago in teaching, but that was about it. Whereas now they're abundant, and I'm not sure whether you have used stuff here at Berkeley at the high school. Have you actually used prediction markets for anything? No, but it's a very powerful way of, again, the old theme, eliciting information from people. And that was different in the old web, which really wasn't about manipulation. This one is about impressions. This was about the impressed. We talked about clicks. You said click the beginning. Clicks is a very old term because clicks assumes HTTP requests, that, you know, you want a page and you get a page. But now, if you go on a web page, from one of my students is a pilot at JetBlue. So into the JetBlue web page, if you unplug your internet connection, you can still look up all kinds of stuff because in the background, those loads things into your browser using Ajax and other technology. So if you just look unplugged, what are the options? What are the prices? How much is it when I fly back on Friday? How much is it when I fly on Saturday, etc.?
JetBlue doesn't know that you are really interacting with the site, building a mental model of how their fare structures work. So that's why we have to come up with new ways of measuring, with new metrics of measuring stuff, metrics of engagement, how attentive was the person, and what can we do to ultimately sell ads on that space, because the ads go where the attention is, the money goes where the attention is. So that was my little remark on your question, and then Florian's remark on, well, what really is new there? If you really think about it, a lot is new, partly because you have just millions of people participating in it, yes. And let me actually summarize this in one simple graph. This is how it used to be, that a few up on top determine what the world is about. Let's say in language, in German, we have the Duden-Redaktion in Mannheim, and they determine how you should write something. Or in French, the Académie Française deciding what it should be. And that pyramid has turned upside down. So now it really is the masses who decide on what is the case. An example would be, also an example just learned last week at this conference, a German website, but you get the idea, motortalk.de. So if you have any questions about your car, and if you speak German, otherwise you won't get very far on the site, then you can go to the site and post it. And as we speak right now, there are, at this moment, 11,000 people, 11,000 people ready to run, ready to answer your questions. 11,000 people have this application running there. So if you want to know something about your Porsche or whatever you have, then people are ready to answer. This is customer service, customer support no single company can ever offer. One image I like to try to sort of, sorry, but you can't see when I draw here, right?
It's okay.
So what you're talking about here is you had the word targeting, the T word. I like the F word better, feedback. Targeting was, says, here's the company, and you target your customers. Then I also saw that C2C and one-to-one in your service. So that was a funny concept which never took off. One-to-one has a very different meaning now. One-to-one is happening down here. One-to-one, as you know, Peppers, etc. wanted, was we figure out what that person really wants. One-to-one is down here. And marketing 2.0, as we call it, is to listen to those conversations which are happening. To listen to those 6,000 or 11,000 people talking about cars right now. As opposed to coming up with blogger and sending that out to targeted audiences. I have a house in Shanghai. And after about 2 weeks of moving in, I started BMW brochures in Chinese. But still, they figured out somebody who buys a house there, he must be interested in BMW. This is what we know as targeting from before. And I think in this feedback economy which we live in, having this communication possibilities, listening to what's happening in this C2C space, C2C in that sense of conversations, marketers conversation, you all know that, is, I think, an important dimension which not everybody in marketing, in the traditional marketing departments, has. I ran a workshop in Switzerland in January, had the country manager of Coca-Cola there, and we talked about this. There's also this video of these guys who have the Coca-Cola Zero and Mentos. Anybody seen that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he said, you know, do them. Yeah. And by the way, we have a professionally produced version now. But unfortunately, nobody wants to see the first version. So that notion that we control the brand, basically, I think is pretty much, corporations are naked. It's no longer the medium is the message, like the one in the 60s. It's the product is the message. And if you have a great product, people want it. There will be these C2C conversations you can listen to. And if you have a lousy product, you can't just pull the wool over people's eyes anymore. In that sense, I think we've become extremely much more honest. And for me, that is an important component of Web 2.0. Yeah?
You mentioned that at Amazon, there's tons of metrics. You can build fancy models to predict everything. But once you get to that level, a marketer, like, get their hands around 100,000 conversations about people talking about your product. Now, how do you aggregate that to the information that, like, your CEO or your CMO can use versus just reading each one?
Okay. Issue management has been actually, if you think about tobacco industries, for instance, an old task for people to do. There are tools out there. One, and I'm not endorsing it, it's just an example, is OpenMind, like Opinion. And what that does is it tries to figure out whether something has positive or primary negative reception on the web. So I don't want to look at Berkeley versus Stanford. That might just be a tricky here. If you look at, let's say, Porsche, or what's Audi, what are you interested in? What are you interested in happening on the web in terms of sentiment?
MySpace.
I'm not sure whether it works for that. Okay, yes. There are 43. What's
the first entry?
Okay. 13 hours ago, yeah. So it's pretty cool. So you have, indeed, 43,000 people. 43,000 entries of people who say, I love it. It's, you know, pretty awesome and stuff like that. And only have 6,000 who say, you know, most people are going to have MySpace sucks and why they, et cetera, et cetera.
So Facebook.
Facebook, again, probably I love Facebook. And I'm starting to hate. So maybe they didn't hate it before. So you see some great, you know, great aggregation thing. What's interesting is to look at it over time. And when you do that, then you can see there are the companies which do this much more fine-grained, but you need to buy a subscription to actually look at that. If some marketing event happens, it's suddenly easier. So there are aggregate tools for that. IBM used to have a part up in Amazon called Web Fountain, but they shut it down because they felt that they couldn't make enough money with it. The market to make money with these things, they're nice to have things, is small. Actually, the entire market for web analytics, how much do you think the market for web analytics, how many billion dollars, $1 trillion? Web analytics meaning tools which you can use to analyze your websites and stuff.
Walmart.
Yeah. What is that?
This is in your...
Yeah, right. So
what did you say?
What is that? 500 million.
What's that?
500 million.
That's a high estimate. So I would have said 200. So that's really not much, because you don't make the money with analytics. What I tried to teach, you make it on the decisions you are driving. I'm not sure what Westness I'm stepping into here, but I mean that's just like, since I don't know the history of, you know, the conversations here,
liberal.
I'm just, you know, telling you what I think. So you make the money by helping people make rights, and analytics is part of it, but it doesn't go very far. And by the way, there's basically no data mining company which ever made money. So I mean, my PhD was in doing neural networks 20 years ago, and so I'm relatively close to that market, and essentially data mining companies never made any money. And then they changed it. It became like revenue science, behavioral targeting and stuff like this, because then the actions. But just for analytics, you know, it's not a way of getting rich. I'm watching the time. We are ending exactly 12:30. Is that right? Okay. So rather than telling you more stories here, let me just see what I had planned here. I want to give for a moment. Yeah, I want to make one remark here. And that's actually Terry O'Dean, who once told me that on his front porch, just thinking about it here. We talked about recommendations, and the point I wanted to make about, the point I have made about recommendations, is that we moved from statistical recommendations to individual recommendations, based on the trajectories of individuals versus based on the aggregation. Okay? And a lot of web OO as recommendations, where you go to the librarian and said, you know, what do you think I should be reading? And she says, you know, the Bible or whatever. One thing which remains open, and I don't have any answer on this, and this is stuff Danny Kahneman actually taught me many years ago. Selection. You know the difference between traditional economics, which tells you how people should behave, how people ought to behave, behavioral economics, which is about modeling how people really do behave. And the web is just a wonderful, wonderful lab to understand how people actually do behave. Probably all of you know this jam example. It was done at some other university on the side of the bay. Where on one day there were 6 jams, on the other day there were 24 jams. You could go to the store and try them out. Who has not seen that example? Okay, then let me just quickly explain it. So, picture this, you're at a supermarket, Dräger's high-end supermarket, and there are 6 jams on the table. And we measure how many customers stopping by. About 40% of the customers stopping by. That's strawberry jam, not bad. And 30% of them actually buy. That was defined by everybody gets a voucher, $1 off, if you do it within a week. Everything was controlled, race, gender, etc. No effects with race and gender. But it turns out, conversion rate 30%. Then everything balanced. 24 jams. 6 were included, not 24 funny jams, but 24, you know, plus the strawberry and so on and so forth. And turns out 60% of the customers actually. After all, be honest, who of us has seen 24 jams to sample? Table in the land. The question for you is, what is the rate? What do you think? I'll give you a hint. The first digit is a 3. And the only digit is 3, right? So what you see here is that in the physical world, we run away from decisions which tracks. Dan Ariely at MIT has done wonderful, wonderful experiments. We did some work together at Match.com on dating sites. And how if we say, well, for you, we have 7,244 matches. For you, we have 3 matches. How much more people are willing to act if there are only 3 matches versus the 7,000 matches? It is not clear in the online world. It really is not clear. It hasn't settled yet. It is the attitude towards selection complexity. And you have the entire spectrum. Wood.com example of having one product a day. So today at Wood, you can IBM Netcom GN9120 wireless headset bundle. That's not bad actually, for $139.90. I think I'll actually buy one. It's there's no customer service because hey. If you don't like it, flip it at eBay. You can get more from it than what you pay for at Wood. So they have one product a day, and this actually is not bad here. So I hope that after class, because once they sell out, that's it. So you have to wait till tomorrow midnight Eastern Standard Time until they show you what the product is tomorrow. That is Wood. Let me give you another example from just yesterday. I saw Zappos. What's funny about that? You laugh about things I don't even know what's funny about. Zappos sells shoes. You probably thought it sells something else, but they actually do sell shoes. So if I look for, let's say, Nike running shoes, that was a typo. Very good. Typo with spelling correction. By the way, how does spelling correction work? Which is very easy. I missed one character, and they figure out. People who spell N-K-E in the next round, in the next iteration, they make it N-I-K-E. So they might as well offer to me right away based on people's behavior. Some guy sitting there and thinking, you know, what should I address one? They figure out from past behavior what they want. And then they tell me, actually, we don't carry Nike. Alrighty. So let's tie Adidas, as they say in this country. So for Adidas, if I look at whatever here, Adidas Performance, they have 103 pages with 99 items per page. So it's a big number. look at those numbers. These are the styles they have. Sample, thousands of shoes by Adidas and Boot, one item a day. Both are doing well. Another example is in Germany, because I worked with a German retailer. There's a company called Jeep, and it says, this is in English, every week a new world. And that means they actually now know what they're presenting in 1 year from now. Did you know that? Chibo knows what will be in each store in 1 year from now.
So you have to explain. So Chibo is a coffee retailer. And
That shows that Floyd and I left Germany like a couple of decades ago.
Yeah, yeah,
no one now thinks we're retail anymore. But.
Okay, fair enough. But in the shops, always a larger assortment of products in addition to coffee. Is that right?
Yeah. But the interesting thing is...
This is 1992 they did.
Yeah.
The last time I was in class.
Yes, yes. So what it is no selection for you. No selection. This week, the same thing in all the Chibo stores in Germany. They do actually a little bit secret. They pick a couple of stores where they try things for a year from now. And you never know which those stores are. Otherwise, you would know what you can buy a year from now. On the other hand, Zazzle. Who knows Zazzle? Okay. Zazzle is the other side of it. Dana Perkins' company. And they have 100,000 designers. 100,000 designers. So that's in some way a company where they have a very smart model of how they compensate the designers. So you see, I'm always sort of interested in a section of the economics, also I've never studied economics. So here's how Zazzle does it. Let's say you have a really gear for design. Now, rather than doing this feudalistic model, like you have to pay every time you print that design on a t-shirt, which we also know from software company like Oracle, feudalism, right? And they are much more capitalist than that and say, okay, you tell us, how much do you want to have? So you're willing to have that design be part of the Zazzle Foundation, whatever they call it. And you think about it, and you say maybe 100, maybe 1,000, maybe 10,000, maybe a million, I don't know how good your design is. Then everybody knows your decision. If I'm now doing t-shirts, and I see your design, and it costs $100, and I can use it forever, but maybe it's not who want to use it, so I only pay $10, everybody pays $10. Then there's a self-regulating mechanism here that if you put too much on the million, no way, because you won't have that million by the specified date and I won't be able to use it anymore. So using against feedback that you can figure out how much should I really say I'm happy with to have, once I got that amount, to have everybody who is being able to use it for free. So that was this point on the side. There's lots of innovation happening in how people get compensated for that stuff and really talk about the future of work for hours here. Point I want to make is 100,000 designers versus one is fixed, or in the case of Wood, one product a day. The verdict is out. The verdict is out what people really want. And there we have the segmentation you asked about before, but not because somebody's left-handed or right-handed, but because some people value options more, should value them, and other people just, you know, maybe value options less than they should value them and just don't care what they're buying. One remark in this context is that even physical manufacturing is dramatically processes due to transparency of the business. I talked to the CEO of Adidas about half a year ago, and he told me that in 48 hours, between him making a decision during the World Cup of what should be printed on those sweatshirts and them appearing in the stores in Germany. Only 48 hours. Whereas others, like Chima, 1 year. Or Zara, the Spanish retailer, when Madonna gave a concert, with all these fashion designers sitting in the first row trying to copy her dress, and within 10 days, you could buy a foot dress in the Zara stores in Barcelona. So it's amazing how basically in a Web 1.0 fashion, those processes through IT, supply chain integration, got streamlined to an incredible degree. You all know probably that case of one other company, I've forgotten, who only stocks their stores roughly half, and then they see what sells, and then you start producing more and more of it. Benetton, I think it was Benetton. I'm not 100% sure. So there's lots of stuff happening, listening to consumers, and going back to this picture here. Not just deciding, this is what people want, that's what we produce, that's what we put in stores, to the conversations, and then acting to that. Okay. Future of work, little Mark. Who knows mturk.com? Okay. Have you used it?
I tried once.
Okay. Did you post the hit or did you get a hit?
No, I got the hit. I do the work, but it was taking too much time.
Okay. And probably the 1 cent per hit was probably not quite, you know, what a Berkeley about to be done with and expect for a few minutes, right? So the idea is that there are things people are good at, and there are things computers are good at. And it doesn't make sense to mix those two. So if you try to do something what a computer is good at, you know, you wouldn't enjoy it. And if you have the computer try to do what people are good at, it wouldn't be all that good. So these hits, the human intelligence tasks, are things where people think that people are good at. So a friend of mine at Amazon was wondering, should he wear a beard or should he not wear a beard? So he posted a picture of himself with a beard and a picture of himself without the beard and gave 1 cent for each judgment. It turned out that 700-something people thought he was cuter without a beard. So what it is you decompose complicated problems into little tasks. For example, I'm doing an MP3 recording for a podcast of this task here. And I'm then interested in getting a transcript. How do I get a transcript? Well, I go to a company called castingwords.com that takes MP3 files, puts them out on Amazon's Mechanical Turk, and for 41 cent a minute of spoken word, I get the transcript back. 41 cent a minute for spoken word. Again, it's not something you would do, I understand that, but there are enough people in the world, India or, you know, whoever, who speaks some English and are willing to actually help out, make a few bucks, maybe worth more in their countries. And this way, actually decomposing work helps us to get stuff done at a very fair price without paying people for sitting in office, even if there's no work for them to do.
Somebody in India is going to groan when they read that and they're typing it.
Which brings me sort of to the last point I wanted to say, because both Florian and the student of Florian's from 2 years, like that step in our way, asked them what should I talk about. They both said, we should talk to them about jobs. And I said to Florian, I'm not going to be doing job counseling for Berkeley students. But what is interesting in data mining in organizations? What is interesting is that you really need two kinds of people in the technical world. And companies which understand this do much better than companies which don't have that distinction. So one kind of people are people who love writing production code. So if you want to write and you don't want it to crash, you want to have people think about exception handling, they get really excited of finding yet another exception they could code and that ever happens. That's one kind of people. The other kind of people are more like sort of the physicist guys who just like to play. They're programmers. Let's try this out. Let's hook that up and, you know, see whether it works. Seems to work. Breaks 5 minutes later. I don't care. I found something and I write my paper. Two very different mindsets of people. And if you hire the wrong person from the other camp into what you need, then you're in big trouble. Where do you need them? In this world where, for instance, Amazon.com, everybody, even a SDE, a software development engineer, one, the lowest level, can run his experiments. He can get maybe 0.1% of the customers to see his brilliant new idea actually will work. So the downside is very small. 0.1% of the customers, you had to run for an hour. If it really screws up, nobody has, then you just turn it off. All this done automatically, doing the analysis. So you have those people who are production engineers, but every now and then they're two. So you actually leverage the creative power of an organization, of in Amazon's case, 1,000 people, in Google's case, 10,000. By giving them tools to play. And for me, why are eBay, Amazon, Google, etc., such innovative companies? I think it's because they have built in their DNA to give people tools that allow people, the engineers, to get the feedback from their customers. Not running surveys, actually, I was the first one who was at Amazon we don't have time for any more, but I would tell you some stories about that, but by doing it as experiments. So I think that is an important message, that you have just to listen to the customer. We have always said this. We have always said this, but it has a very different meaning, I think, now compared to what it had 10 years ago. Any other questions? Yeah.
So you've been a part of several startups, and we talk about learning from the customers and thinking about at what point did you, is there a point early on where it wasn't technical, it wasn't IT related, where it's more the conversations with them or talking to them, and if so, when does it transition over to being more built into the tech specs?
I think failing is a very good thing. So talking to people, again, big difference between Germany and here actually is. I was part in Germany, the first party after 21 years in Berlin, and half the people said, oh, I'm the founder of this. So what do you do? Well, talk about this. Whereas, at least on the other side of the bay, if I have a party at my house, everybody's excited about what they're doing, more than happy to talk about it, because they know they need back before anything is built, before the technical stuff happens, from their friends, from other people who they know. So I think the feedback doesn't mean that it needs to be feedback which actually is on a live system. That's great, and many of the examples I showed by definition were live systems. But the Valley, I think, has such a rich culture of feedback on the conversations that talking to people, you can learn a lot. Talking to experienced people allows you to avoid so many mistakes. Some people still insist those mistakes, you can't help them. But there is a lot of knowledge of what has worked, what hasn't worked. I don't believe really in having people who have no idea trying to answer your questions. So I'm not sure who of you knows about social search. Social search has a number of meanings. One of them is Yahoo Answers. And it's exciting because there's another company on the side of the bay called Illumio. And Illumio, what they do is they scan your hard drive. They look at every single file you have. And then if somebody has a question, if your hard drive seems to actually be equipped to answer that, then they will show you that person and his or her question. So I was really surprised when I saw that, because somebody asked me a question here.
Okay, some guy from Stanford GSB. And that is one way of doing so much, of dealing with the problem of information overload by only showing me out of these millions of questions hitting my computer hour, only those where students stand information retrieval, it seems that I actually have a pretty good answer other people don't have. That's not what Yahoo Answers is about. The most popular question on Yahoo Answer in Korea is, why people close their eyes when they kiss? And the most popular question on Yahoo Answers in China is, what happens when your mobile phone falls into the I think that's a good point to end.
Yeah. Thank you so much.